British Columbia later learned that child welfare workers contacted the hospital before their baby was born. If this happened to you, you may be part of the Birth Alerts BC class action settlement. Some people will receive notice directly. Others may not know this happened. Visit birthalertsbc.ca or call the info line at 1-833-632-6557.
Hi, my name is Taku. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Hale, and with me, as per usual, is Brandon.
Some interesting texts, some interesting kind of almost like poetry, not exactly by someone that you would think of as like a philosopher or a like professional thinker, because today we're going to be talking about John Lennon. And we're going to be kind of analyzing some of his lyrics for their philosophical content. We're not like music critics, so we're not exactly going to be talking about like the music side of it, though maybe that insofar like as it has something to do with the ideas. But I think this will be really it'll be really interesting. I haven't spent a lot of time with John Lennon. I haven't spent a lot of time with the Beatles in general. I'll be honest, my music tastes are a little more electronic, but of course they have something to do with that. We might bring that up, but it'll be interesting to dive into such an important and influential pop group and kind of really see what people get out of them.
It's a kind of a popular thinker examination episode. I think you and I kind of talked about it, like examining an artist for philosophical ideas. John Lennon, before we get into a little bit about who he is, just a tiny bit more, I think is a great first choice for us to kind of jump off and do an episode like this, because while he was not overtly a, you know, systematic philosopher producing big, you know, works of philosophy and systems and such like that, he was certainly someone who thought in a wider philosophical, spiritual way. And that was very clear also through his artwork and his interviews and what he said. It makes it kind of an interesting option of kind of like, you know, we're really trying to look at the, you know, someone's artwork and kind of tease out the philosophical ideas that are present in that artwork. And Lennon clearly had a lot of that. Now, before we get into that, as our listeners know, we usually start the episode with a quote and quandary. I think today we've just got one little quote from me, which in some ways is actually prescient to today's content. And the quote is from Danny McBride. And if listeners don't know who that is he's an actor. His quote was, "All culture has been preserved." And when he said that, I immediately pictured preserved as like, you know, in jam jars in a cellar or whatever. But obviously he was talking about how in the modern day, all sorts of cultural items, bits of media, whatever it might be, have been sort of preserved by current technology and have been made accessible to everyone at all times. You know, this is something we've talked about on the show many times before, but I think it's worth kind of reviewing, because that's not always how culture has worked, right? Like for so much of human history, you know, culture has been much more specific cultures have been much more imbued with specific eras and times and places and stuff like that. And the transitions have kind of left things behind, or things have been deleted or lost or whatever. But now everything is kind of saved, you know, backed up or accessible by modern technology, and it creates this weird shift in the temporality of culture and cultural items, which we're even displaying on this show, because obviously John Lennon and the Beatles are, you know, cultural icons that actually existed and produced, you know, now over half a century ago, right? Like, so we're not talking about someone who is really current. We're talking about someone who's well in the past, but because of modern technology, because of modern media, they're just as accessible in many ways as they were in 1969 or 1970 or whatever.
Yeah, I get that feeling sometimes even reading like ancient philosophy or medieval philosophy or something like that. You know, this is kind of a preoccupation I have. It's kind of a question like, how did this get here? And by that, I mean, the text, and by here I mean like in my hands, right? Some editor or publisher or a translator worked through a manuscript and produced something, and now it's in my hands. Sometimes that thing, that text, is from ancient Greece, sometimes it's from ancient China, sometimes it's from like medieval Europe. But there is this like really interesting kind of effect where if you just have access to all of these ideas, there is like a kind of you would think that there's like this solidification that can happen where we have access to everything and now we can kind of reconcile all these ideas. But in a way, it interrupts like the way that time used to work by virtue of the technologies which mediated these texts and these communications. And so now we have like comparing, like there's lots of great literature comparing ancient Greek, like specifically Aristotelian virtue ethics with Confucian virtue ethics, right? This is something that would not have been possible, you know, during the medieval period, and not just because they didn't like have access to it or anything, right? It would have been because like the technology, like, well, first of all, like even if they did have it, the technologies wouldn't have allowed them to like make those comparisons because the promulgation of the texts and such were just not, they wouldn't be there in like such a temporal way, right? And the other thing too is like the fact that you can compare not just across like particular traditions, but across time, right? So that like we can compare, or you can like analyze like very modern situations through like an ancient perspective or something like that. It has this almost like flattening effect, as it were.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that it has this kind of flattening effect. And part of that, I think, is, you know, as we've become, as our, you know, kind of, you know, the modern Library of Alexandria, as you might kind of think of it, this accessibility of media and culture from everywhere and all points of time and all this kind of stuff. It has this effect of, we've talked about this before, it kind of reminds me of people like Mark Fisher and stuff talking about things like hauntology and stuff like that, where, you know, things are never new. And part of that is also the fact that, like, well, now you create a new cultural product, a new piece of media or whatever. It's always comparable to something that's probably going to be similar because there's so much stuff that's out there, right? Like you could say, oh, I've made this new thing, or I've come up with this new idea, or I made this new piece of art. And it's very easy to go, oh, well, actually, that's just like, you know, such and such ancient Chinese writer had this idea back then, or, oh, well, the Maori over here did similar artwork, actually, blah, blah, you might not have known about that. It's very difficult for things to become new. Everything kind of has this sort of, as Danny McBride kind of said, it's kind of preserved, it's kind of stagnated to all be, as you also say, kind of leveled out, all the sort of the same.
There is a woodblock printing technique called ukiyo-e, or like a tradition of it in Japanese wood printing called ukiyo-e, and it is a specific genre of woodblock printing where it documents and depicts everyday life, right? Ukiyo-e meaning in Japanese images of the floating world, and here floating world is like a Buddhist metaphor for everyday life where things are just kind of slipping by, right? They have these sort of ephemeral kind of feelings to them because you're depicting everyday scenes, but it was also used to depict just like a lot of the great works or collections of them are like collections of views of Mount Fuji along particular highways and roads. So they document things like in a very particular time. Now, since they're woodblock prints, that's a particular technology that if you wanted to, you could reproduce them and you could make your own ukiyo-e, right? You could go and you could learn how to make the particular sumi or the inks for it, or like the particular gradients that are like really nice to look at. They give these like really, really impressive coloring effects, but they aren't really, you're not going to capture like a hokusai, right? You're not going to be able to be in that time where hokusai was making the ukiyo-e that we know and was like really culturally important for Japan at the time, right? There is this kind of like leveling effect in that way of like going on YouTube and learning how to make ukiyo-e. which kind of goes to this idea of like, you know, there is almost a certain way that that quote is right in saying that, you know, all culture has been preserved, but in certain ways, cultures are also preserved by their secrecy. Not necessarily like their secrecy, but like the fact that only certain institutions have the capacity to produce things, or that there's like particular tastes that you have to have. You know, it seems like very anti-egalitarian. And I guess that is like sort of the zeitgeist that comes along with these technologies, is that, you know, in a sort of mass produced society that we have, where all sorts of things are becoming more and more and more accessible, the ideal of like having people who are in the know, that ideal kind of goes away, because this promise of like, well, if we just give everyone the tools, just imagine what people are going to come up with. You know, we believe that people are creative, and that means like inherently spontaneous, and if you just give people the tools, they'll come up with something interesting. But if you look at, you know, most stuff that people produce with the tools that you give them, it's a sea of crap, you know. Like, look at, I mean, I don't know, maybe like early YouTube or something, where people are getting their hands on and being able to put out videos for the first time in the way that YouTube does. It's not, you know, I don't like, you might have nostalgia for like early YouTube, but most of it is people just like uploading music by running MP3s through like Windows Movie Maker and then uploading it as a video file.
or doing very kind of cringy skits or whatever.
Like right? That.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, speaking of you know, creatives and media and all that kind of stuff, I think it's a nice roll in with the cultural item. I guess you could probably call him a cultural item at this point of John Lennon. I think it's worth saying very briefly, just kind of like who this person was, like we do with, you know, many of the other thinkers and people we analyze on the show. Obviously, John Lennon was one of the, you know, kind of the lead members of, or not kind of, he was one of the lead members along with Paul McCartney of the Beatles, which were the, you know, the kind of seminal band of the 1960s, very much, you know, widely considered to be by many musicians and critics and people to be the most, at least the most influential rock band, pop rock band, you know, in history, and, you know, really changed the game in terms of what popular music was, you know, and kind of the quality and expectations of songwriting. And Lennon himself, I think a lot of people, he really became a cultural icon in his own time, which we'll kind of talk about, and was also very much a poet as much as he was a musician. Obviously he was a musician, but, you know, he also wrote a lot of poetry. He considered himself a poet. And even as there's a, for the show today, we'll be looking a lot at like kind of his lyrics and basing all that, and also off of a Philosophy Now article, Philosophy Now being the popular philosophy website that, magazine website that many of our listeners can easily check out, called The Philosophy of John Lennon. But, you know, even there's actually an interesting quote in that article that says, John Lennon said, "In another age, I would have been called a philosopher." So I think even he was aware on some level of his sort of creative output having some philosophical underpinnings. You know, another quote before we kind of get into it is, you know, from 1965, Lennon kind of said, which is very existentially sounding, you know, "The more I have, the more I see, the more I experience, and the more I experience, I get, the more confused I become as to who I am and what the hell life is all about." So that was him in 1965. So this is clearly someone, he was clearly someone who was questioning a lot about, you know, the kind of the meaning of life, the meaning of his life. I think it's worth saying a very short biography in the sense of Lennon was born in 1940. He grew up in Liverpool along with all the other Beatle members, and that's where their band started. you know, I'm sure most of our listeners are kind of, this is one of the most famous stories of, you know, kind of Western culture. So I'm sure most people are familiar with it, but it's worth noting that he grew up, you know, kind of quite working class. He had quite a bad upbringing, even for a tortured musician. Both of his parents abandoned him. His mother, who he had some sort of weird relationship with, was killed by a drunk driver right out in front of his home when he was a teenager. You know, so he there was a lot of, he was a very kind of classic, angsty, upset, artsy kid who then became this sort of rock star figure and one of the first real iconic, like, rock stars, you know, kind of famous icons, right? But he also became someone who was very self-reflective and very contemplative about what all this kind of meant for him and what he was doing with his life and all that kind of stuff. And you can kind of see that through a lot of his work. So we're going to talk a little bit about what we see there. I think before we get into that a little bit more, it's worth noting Lenin's own philosophical interests, as far as we know, from what he said and wrote. He was quite interested in Eastern philosophy and read the Bhagavad Gita, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, other Buddhist works. He was really into meditation. And he also read quite a bit of kind of esoteric Christian mysticism and kind of weird stuff like that. So that's kind of his, at least from what we understand, his kind of philosophical background, which is quite apparent in a lot of his work.
It's also kind of worth, like, situating him within that cultural moment as well, right? Like, I'm not particularly, like, well-versed in, you know, the philosophy of the hippies and whatnot, but that was very much so, like, a particular strain of popular understanding of philosophy, you know. And I think actually it survives quite well into today. You know, when you ask people, or when I tell people sometimes that I study philosophy, sometimes they'll understand that to mean, you know, I read these kind of esoteric texts that people who are trying to drop out of society read, or that are trying to, like, pierce through the veil of reality in this kind of, like, psychedelic way, you know. Like, it's worth noting that the two books, the Bhagavad Gita and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that John Lennon read, were read on the recommendation of Timothy Leary, who was a pretty well-known figure within the counterculture at the time, is advocating as for psychedelics as a means into, like, a more, like, integrated experience, right? The Eastern tradition brings in, and the hippie movement also starts integrating techniques of, like, meditation to try and attain that as well. As far as I know, that he experimented with transcendental meditation, which is a particular form of, like, very, like, powerful meditation. He had a guru who taught him meditation, and so he was steeped in that zeitgeist at the time of trying to find meaning, not through, you know, some philosophers might do it, through, like, theory or, you know, understanding, like, the structure that they exist in, but trying to transcend his world in a way of trying to break onto, like, more meaningful experiences through different traditions that advocated for these, like, particular practices.
He's a particularly interesting figure in that way, because he was someone who very clearly took bits and pieces from a lot of these different thinkers and combined them and reconstrued them and kind of had his own twist, you know.
He was eclectic in that way, but he wasn't just a consumer of that. We'll talk about this when we get into the lyrics, but he was not just a passive consumer of, like, the Eastern tradition in that way.
Yeah, I remember there was actually a really interesting interview with David Bowie, another kind of seminal rock star figure who was a little bit after Lennon. And someone in this interview with Bowie asked him who his greatest teacher was, and he said his greatest teacher was John Lennon. And the, you know, obviously the interviewer asked David Bowie why. And, you know, to paraphrase, Bowie said something like, you know, Lennon's great talent was being able to take, you know, esoteric, avant-garde, complex ideas and repackage and reconstrue them in a way that was more available and understandable to a general audience, which David Bowie said it was kind of like, you know, one of the most impressive things that he ever saw an artist do, right? And you see a lot of that kind of come through in his, because obviously a lot of the stuff that he did was chart topping music. It wasn't, yeah, it wasn't like
he was demonstrably successful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. He was kind of like the guy, you know, unquestionably one of the most famous people during his lifetime and since. So, you know, he had this way of kind of taking a lot of these kind of more esoteric whatever ideas and making them available to people who otherwise probably wouldn't have much exposure to them. I really think that there's like a few different aspects to look at, though, because like obviously as philosophers we love to like break down and categorize things. Lenin came to a kind of ethical view that was very, as you said, kind of seminal of the hippie movement, this kind of peace and love, you know, kind of worldview. There's a lot of different songs that really attribute that, but you know, there's the most obvious one is going to be like his song Imagine. But there's a number of other songs as well that really, you know, emphasize the sort of songs as well, like All You Need Is Love, which really emphasize the idea that, you know, the most important thing in life is, you know, the power of, you know, love and a kind of humanism and care towards other people as being the central connecting aspect between each other, but also a guiding principle in every person's individual life. He reduces ethical system, you know, to kind of like a humanistic power of love and respect. Like you could almost say he believed society could elevate itself if people focused more on self-transformation and, you know, treated each other as kind of more like familial, as kind of like brothers and sisters, as a kind of one human being.
It's pacifistic and it's borderline sentimental, but at the same time, he takes it so seriously that it's easy to be suspicious of the sentimentality of it. He does take very seriously this idea of turning your attention inward and trying to sort of not so much focus on difference, not so much focus on what divides, but just on the core of your being and then seeing that in others, that we really are all just one people. There is the human race, and there is such a... Well, he says, first of all, there is such a thing, and this thing is equally all worthy of dignity and respect. You do that through loving.
It's a good place to start because it's probably what he's most well known for. Like people picture John Lennon, they picture, as you kind of said, the hippie movement, long hair, the glasses, that, you know, and, you know, there's also songs like, you know, like songs like Give Peace a Chance, which are these kind of like, they're almost more like Buddhist influenced chants than they are songs, where it's this kind of repetitive message over and over again about the importance of peace and love. And this is sort of this sort of very outward looking vision of, you know, interrelationships, you know, globally, but also too, there's this really strong emphasis, as you said, in the fact that that process starts with you, the individual, right? Like if you can't kind of like, you can't love other people if you hate yourself or if you're doing harm to yourself, right? You need to start with you first. Which is
it makes a lot of sense considering the ideas that are sort of the bedrock for this, right? In meditative practices, you're focusing very much so on your own experience, and you're interrogating. Well, you're not really interrogating your own experience, but in meditation, the goal is to come to see past the. The goal of meditation is to achieve what's called a meditative state, which is a sort of disassociation or disidentification between you and your thoughts. It's taking away all of the things that you think you are and stripping those away and realizing what you really are, which to meditators is more or less just the fact that you are an experiencer, right? But in stripping away all that baggage, you remove a lot of the trappings and attachments that can cause strife, right? So if you realize that you aren't how much money you have, because money's just an institution, everyone has money because they have the institution of money, right? They all have access to it. Then you stop identifying with how much money you have and you can spread it more freely. Or when you are really honest in your experience, you can give it to those who are in need, right? So it puts you in a particular position to attend to the world in a certain way, and because of that, to respond to it, right? Like, in that way, Lenin is kind of anticipating something like an ethic of attention, where by kind of cultivating his attention in this way.
Actually, I want to read a quote from the Philosophy Now article, because I think it really sums up what was going on here personally for Lenin with this kind of outward vision. In the article, they say they're speaking with John and Yoko Ono, Lenin's second wife, who was very much involved in this whole era and kind of, you know, thinking as well, resolved to make their life their art, capitalizing on Lenin's almost unequaled access to media to bring attention to the cause of world peace. Their objective, he said, was to keep peace on the front pages, displacing stories about politicians and diplomats making still more empty promises. And he and Yoko didn't care if journalists considered them fools as long as their antics were getting reported. So I think that's exactly what you're saying. So, you know, you have someone who sort of realizes, okay, well, maybe my life vision can be spreading peace and love. How am I actually going to do that? How am I going to actualize that? If that's kind of my own, you know, internal self-understanding, well, because I'm this big rock star guy with all this media attention and access, I can really kind of, to use a modern phrase, flood the zone with these sorts of ideas, and, you know, hopefully more and more people will kind of pick up on it and be a part of it. And I really, like you said, in the article as well, it notes how he used the term mind guerrillas, which I think is a really interesting concept, but it's also very reflective of his own period, right? Because, you know, guerrilla in that term is used as guerrilla warfare. Lenin in particular was talking during the era of the Vietnam War, where guerrilla warfare was very much a thing. And this idea of the mind guerrillas, you know, like, if all of us start sort of working in concert with the same sort of ideas, then maybe these really like pie in the sky hopes and dreams about the world might actually come true, because enough of us are actually focusing on making this thing happen, right? Enough of us are imagining it, enough of us are wanting it, so therefore, like, it might actually come to be, or at least we might get a little bit closer to the goal.
I remember learning about the bed-in with Lenin and Ono, this protest of just like staying in bed, and I always wondered, like, what is this? Like, it's a protest, but you don't even do any, it's almost like more pointless than a sit-in where you actually like go to the place you're protesting. What is the point? The idea of the mind guerrilla really puts it in perspective, because, you know, John Lennon is a very, 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 very famous person. In fact, probably one of the most famous people that would have been occupying the news media at the time. So to interrupt the news media as far as, hey, I'm going to, you know, hang out in bed, and this is going to be like plastered all over the paper. Is this going to be on the news? Is this going to be on TV? And they have to pay attention to him because he's famous, right? Like, that's what this whole system is predicated upon, is paying attention to famous people for the fact that they're famous. John and Yoko Ono are going to do something with this. That's kind of like, do something that doesn't do anything, but by virtue of that, it kind of does something, and it shows up that the things that on TV seem like they're all about something, you know, politicians going on TV saying they're like implementing or thinking about this policy, or like there's this advocacy, or like they're showing a protest. These look like they have some, like they're doing something, but actually, because they participate in this ecosystem of mass media that's emerging, they're pointless. So it kind of like subverts that in a way by doing this like silly, you know, playing his guitar in his bed.
From his song Give Me Some Truth, which was released around the era of the bed-in, he wrote, I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is some truth. Give me some truth. No short-haired, yellow-bellied son of Tricky Dicky, and Tricky Dicky is President Nixon, by the way, is going to mother